Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Wednesday, June 12th, 2024. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Nez Perce County Grand Jury indicts prison escape suspects from Boise in murder of Julietta man. Pullman Council to discuss Gaza passage at June 25th meeting, but passage of a resolution not likely soon, and Latah County Courts and Prosecutor's Office want increased budgets due to Koberger quadruple murder trial. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And you're tuned to KRFP Moscow Pullman and live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho. I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. A Nez Perce County grand jury has indicted the man who escaped from the prison at Kuna in March and his alleged accomplice for the murder of a Julietta man during the 36 hours they were on the run. The grand jury indicted 32-year-old Skylar Mead and 29-year-old Nicholas Umfenauer for the first-degree murder of 83-year-old James Mahoney. Prosecutors in Ada County have already indicted Mead and Umfenauer on charges related to the escape, which left two prison guards wounded in a shootout at an ambulance bay of a Boise hospital. Police say after the escape, Mead and Umfenauer headed to northern Idaho, where they abducted Mahoney, who was walking his dogs, and took him, his dogs, and his 2019 Chrysler Pacific to a remote farm field near Leland, east of Julietta. Searchers found Mahoney's body there. Police later found the dogs alive. Mead and Umfenauer are also suspected of killing 72-year-old Gerald Don Henderson, who was found dead in his remote cabin near Orofino. Umfenauer had stayed with Henderson at his cabin the year before. According to the Spokesman Review, Nez Perce County Prosecutor Justin Coleman said, "These indictments are the first step in the process of seeking justice for James Mahoney. We have a long way to go to reach the conclusion we want and will continue to work diligently with law enforcement agencies throughout the state to ensure we have the strongest case possible to present at trial." Corrections officers had taken Mead to St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center in Boise for treatment for self-inflicted injuries, and police say Umfenauer showed up and engaged in a shootout with police that allowed them to escape in a gray Honda Civic. Court documents say Umfenauer shot two of the prison guards and a third was shot by a Boise police officer arriving on the scene who mistakenly believed the guard was a perpetrator. All three of those shot are expected to fully recover. Authorities arrested the two 36 hours later without incident at Filer, Idaho, which is near Twin Falls. Court documents say Umfenauer and Mead served together at the Idaho Correctional Facility at Kuna until January, when the prison released Umfenauer. The two were reportedly part of a white supremacist prison gang. In addition to the murder charge, Umfenauer faces charges from Ada County for assault on law enforcement, aiding a prison escape, and illegal possession of firearms. Mead faces an additional charge of drug possession and prison escape. A Nez Perce County Prosecutor's Office press release says correction officers will transport the two from Boise, where they are in custody, to Lewiston for their arraignment. Idaho Press Club President Melissa Davlin, who reports for Idaho Public Television, has launched the Idaho First Amendment Alliance, which is a nonprofit that intends to challenge government agencies when they lack transparency. Davlin told the Idaho Capital Sun the alliance intends to show that Idaho journalists are serious about government transparency. The Idaho Press Club has sued the state government twice in the last 2 years for refusing to provide public records. Davlin says the lawsuits took a lot of resources. She said, "Unfortunately, we don't always have the ability to do that. We've had to leave some denials unchallenged simply because we don't always have the funds, the time, or the resources to take somebody to court." as an industry where we are facing so many challenges to the fiscal health of corporate newsrooms and small newsrooms, and trying to figure out what our industry is going to look like over the next 20 or 30 years, I think it's important that we, as a statewide organization, are able to provide these tools for reporters. Under Idaho law, denials of public records requests can only be challenged in court. Some of the recent challenges to government secrecy include the Idaho Press Club's 2021 lawsuit against Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan, whose office repeatedly refused to fulfill reporters' public records requests about emailed public testimony during McGeehan's Indoctrination in Education Task Force probe. The Idaho Press Club successfully sued Ada County in 2019 over withholding of public records. Last year, the Coeur d'Alene Press successfully sued North Idaho College for denying the public access to employment contract information.
Idaho ranks 13th in a new report on child well-being. The Annie E. Casey Foundation's annual Kids Count Data Book measures how well states are supporting children and families in four categories: economic well-being, education, health, and family and community. The state fares well overall, but the head of Idaho Voices for Children, Christine Tiddens, notes it lags behind in the education metric. She says one cause is the high prevalence of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, which include things like economic hardship within the family or living with someone with a mental illness or substance abuse issue.
Higher rates of ACEs can and do keep Idaho students from coming to school ready to learn or even coming to school at all.
Idaho ranks 38th in education, but the state did well in other areas, including scoring 9th in the health category and 4th in family and community. Like other states around the country, Idaho has struggled with education post-pandemic. However, Leslie Bossier with the Casey Foundation says the pandemic is not solely to blame for worsening educational outcomes. She says this has been an issue for a long time.
For example, the pandemic erased decades of increases in math scores. However, if you look over the 35 years that we've produced the data book, we've never seen a significant percentage of children who were either proficient in fourth grade reading or basic math.
Tiddin says to get back on track, Idaho policymakers need to prioritize ensuring kids arrive at the classroom ready to learn by doing things like providing greater access to affordable meals.
That they have a safe home, that they feel safe and have somewhere to study with their friends, and that they have access to teachers and counselors who understand the impact of an unstable home and are able to help find resources for them.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
The Latah County District Court is asking the county government to increase the office's jury supply budget from $3,500 to $150,000. The increase in funding is tied to the expected number of jurors who might have to travel to the trial of quadruple murder suspect Brian Koberger. Under next year's proposed budget, up to a total of $25,000 would be paid to all witnesses, compared to this year's budget for witnesses that would top out at $3,500. The increases are due to the expected costs of the coming trial of Brian Koberger, who prosecutors say stabbed 4 University of Idaho students to death in an off-campus rental house in Moscow in November 2022. According to the Lewiston Tribune, the costs for the prosecutor's office are expected to increase if the defense is successful in getting a change of venue, because Latah County will have to pay travel and lodging costs for Prosecutor Bill Thompson's staff. Thompson's office is asking the county to budget $135,000 for trial costs next fiscal year, which is the same the county allocated to the prosecutor's office this year. Before the Koberger case, Thompson's office usually asked for $15,000 for trial expenses. fire crews were successful in stopping a wind-driven wildfire last night, which threatened 100 homes southwest of Spokane. The wildfire burned 75 acres in timber and brush, causing the evacuation of dozens of homes. Someone first reported the fire at about 2:10 p.m. before it spread from a large slash pile in the 7800 block of South Grove Road. Winds gusting up to 45 miles per hour spread the blaze. The spokesman review reports firefighters used a bulldozer, helicopters, and a hand crew of 100 people to stop the fire. Jessa Lewis of the State Natural Resources Department said three airplanes also dropped water on the fire during the afternoon, and two helicopters were dropping water into the night. The Pullman City Council decided last night to hold a discussion at the Tuesday, June 25th meeting on a proposed resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and an end to the Israeli attacks on Palestinian civilians. A number of people spoke at the meeting supporting the resolution and some opposed. Here's some of those who spoke.
But I'm speaking right now in order to urge the council to place the resolution for an immediate and permanent ceasefire and an end to occupation and apartheid in Palestine on the next meeting agenda and to pass it. The resolution calls for an immediate permanent ceasefire, an end to U.S. military aid to the Israeli apartheid regime, the release of the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners held by Israel without trial, and an end to the siege on Gaza, the occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and all discriminatory laws against Palestinians and Israel itself. Pullman's a relatively small city, but in passing this resolution, we would be joining over 100 cities across the country in calling for an end to the genocidal Israeli war on Gaza, which has killed over 35,000 people, over 14,000 of them children, has targeted schools, hospitals, residential buildings and humanitarian aid workers, and has cut off electricity, water, and food supplies, risking massive casualties from famine and disease. Israel is currently attacking Rafah, where 1.4 million of Gaza's 1.9 million residents have taken shelter since the start of the war, leading 450,000 of them to be displaced once again. The U.S. government is Israel's largest military sponsor, providing the apartheid state with $3 billion a year in military aid, and has offered an additional $24 billion to support the current war on genocide. Since the federal government and Biden administration are supporting the genocide of Palestinians, it falls to the people of the United States and cities like Pullman to show our solidarity and demand an end to war and genocide. Calling for an end to this war has nothing to do with any form of hate or prejudice, such as anti-Semitism or the comments of any individual in the community, no matter what they've said, but is driven by a desire for all people to be able to flourish in peace and equality, which is why Jewish organizations such as If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace have called for an end to the war and the occupation, and some of the largest demonstrations in cities across the U.S. have been Jewish-led. Pullman is also home to a community of Muslim and Arab residents who have faced a nationwide climate of hostility and Islamophobic violence since last year, and students at Washington State University have demanded that the university divest from companies closely tied to Israeli occupation, apartheid, and genocide.
I think it is ignorant to ask us to not address the situation by the fact that I see these things. Our children are seeing these things on our phones, on our TVs, on the news. It's inevitable. So to not address this situation would be ignorant. I do not claim any heritage on either side, and I do not have family. However, I am a member of the LGBTQ community, and I know what it's like to have people stand up for you and to have people silence you. So it is important to me to show up today and ask that you please address this issue and that you please honestly do your part as representatives, because I know that there are many of us here in Pullman who deeply care about the issue on all sides of it, and I don't claim any anti-Semitism. What I do claim is justice for all. And I believe that our American values are based off of protest and revolution. Shay's Rebellion, the American Revolution, our LGBTQ rights movement, all of these things that have progressed America and have included diversity and other people and made people feel safe are all founded on protest and standing up when things are wrong.
I'm Jewish. I'm a Zionist. I love Israel. I have family there. My heart is absolutely broken by what is happening in Gaza. My heart is broken by the hostages that were taken October 7th. My heart is broken. And I, as a Jew, a religious Jew, I can hold all of this complexity at once. I adamantly condemn the Israeli government. It is not the government of Yitzhak Rabin that I grew up with. I condemn Hamas. I live here in this community, and when I read the resolution that's being submitted, it left me out.
Those were some of the members of the public who spoke at last night's Pullman City Council meeting. Councilmember Carla De Lira and Eric Fajerin spoke in favor of the resolution. Here's De Lira.
As a public official, it is my duty to bring into discussion what community members care about. My constituents want to see a resolution passed, which calls for state and federal public officials to push for an immediate permanent ceasefire, an end to the U.S. military aid to Israel that funds the escalating humanitarian crisis and loss of life in the Middle East, and the release of both captive Israeli and Palestinian civilians. I am aware that this having this discussion is difficult, but it is not new among local municipalities. In fact, over 100 local municipalities, including in Washington, have passed the ceasefire resolution. And as a city, we would be joining in solidarity with other cities to put pressure on the U.S. federal government to act to end this extreme humanitarian crisis that is being funded through our tax dollars. As stewards of our city's tax dollars, and as a city that does rely on federal services and money, we must feel responsible to weigh in, and it sounds like I have the support of my council members to have that discussion.
That was Pullman City Councilmember Carla De Lira. Councilmember Trymaine Gaither and Mayor Francis Benjamin spoke against the resolution.
I want to talk for a minute about the particular resolution that was sent to us. While well-intentioned, it's not balanced. It's just not balanced. It does not acknowledge the harm caused on all sides, including the violent attacks committed by Hamas on October 7th. The resolution does not call for a safe and immediate release of hostages and Israeli hostages. Additionally, when the resolution calls for the city to tell Washington State what to do, to divest from companies tied to Israel, that goes beyond the appropriate scope of our local government. It just does. I believe this resolution, the resolution that was sent to us, creates a perception of partisanship that is inappropriate for our nonpartisan local government.
As Pullman, we need to welcome everyone in our community. We don't pick who, as a person, as a nation, or as a culture, who is welcome in our community and who isn't. That's not as the city's task. And the resolution, there's a number of items in the resolution where winners and losers are picked. And that is not something I can support in any fashion at all. It pits, and where similar resolutions to this have been brought to other communities, it has brought division in the community rather than a welcoming community. And for me, as mayor, my focus is first on my community and the impact that it has on the community. And I want a community that is a welcoming community, that all people feel comfortable, welcome, that they feel that this is a place they can call home. This is also an international concern, and it needs to be addressed to the congressional delegation, not here.
That was Pullman Mayor Francis Benjamin. The council will move forward with further discussion of the issue at the June 25th meeting, but Mayor Francis Benjamin said the council will be limited as to what it can do at that meeting.
The agenda item on the 25th is a discussion item. No action can be taken from the discussion item. If there is a request for it to be put onto a regular agenda where action would happen, it would then be required to go through the staff and legal review. And until that staff and legal review is done, it will not come back to council.
That was Pullman Mayor Francis Benjamin speaking at last night's Pullman City Council meeting. The Pullman Planning Commission is expected to review a draft proposal for rules for short-term rentals in the city, including Airbnbs, at two workshops this month and next. City officials will also take feedback on a draft code for short-term rental rules via email. Assistant City Planner Ariel Madieros said the rules update for the short-term rentals are part of an effort to update the entire zoning code for the city. Madieros told the Daily News city officials cannot determine the exact number of short-term rentals in the city because they are advertised on many platforms such as Bedfinder, Airbnb, Vrbo, Facebook, and Craigslist. Short-term rentals are currently defined in the city under boarding houses, which are not allowed in the R1 and R2 residential districts, although people can open short-term rentals in the R2 district if they obtain a conditional use permit from the city. The short-term rentals would be allowed in single-family homes, duplexes, or as accessory dwelling units. City code would only allow one per parcel, and units would have to be between 200 and 900 square feet. The planning document also says in the case of accessory dwelling units, the primary residence must be occupied at least 6 months per year. Prospective short-term rental landlords would have to pay a $350 application fee to the city, and it would cost $150 for each annual renewal. Applicants would have to provide the city with a floor plan that would include evacuation routes. Applicants would also need to obtain a business license from the State Department of Revenue. The applicants must also inform the city which websites they are using to advertise these short-term rentals. There would be a 10-day public comment period for new short-term rentals, and if anyone opposes the plans, the Pullman Hearing Examiner would be called in. Those who wish to comment on the proposed changes to the city short-term rental rules can email Pullman Assistant Planner Ariel Madieros at ariel.madieros@pullman-wa.gov. That's ariel.medieros@pullman-wa.gov. The Planning Commission workshops on the draft short-term rental rules will occur at meetings Wednesday, June 26th at 7 p.m. and Wednesday, July 24th, also at 7 p.m. Both meetings will take place at City Hall. The City Council is expected to hold a formal public hearing on the proposed code changes Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at City Hall.
Critical minerals are crucial for the United States' clean energy future, but civil society and environmental groups are raising concerns about the working conditions under which these minerals are mined in other countries. Nickel, cobalt, lithium, and other minerals are mined and shipped to the U.S. for use in manufacturing electric vehicles, long storage batteries, microchips, and solar panels. Clayton Tucker is with the nonprofit Trade Justice Education Fund and says conditions in countries where the minerals are mined do not meet U.S. standards.
Mining cobalt, there's artisan mines, and child slavery is very, very commonly used. With nickel in Indonesia, the mine that you basically have to raise entire parts of the jungle and raise basically entire indigenous communities.
Some of Washington's most important industries, including clean energy, transportation, and aerospace, rely on these critical minerals. Tucker and representatives from 38 other countries recently testified at a hearing with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, calling for more stringent requirements for future critical mineral agreements between the U.S. and other countries. The only CMA that currently exists is between the United States and Japan. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative says the agreement strengthens and diversifies critical minerals supply chains and promotes the adoption of electric vehicle battery technologies. But the environmental groups say the agreement doesn't go far enough to ensure that workers and the environment are protected, and that it sets a concerning precedent. Tucker says the contracts come with certain perks, and the U.S. needs to leverage its power.
We need these minerals. We're basically trying to make sure that if you receive a subsidy, a tax credit, or any form of other support, that you play by our rules with climate protection, you play by our rules with labor protections.
Funding from the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act is helping to bring supply chain manufacturing back to the United States in some instances, including two projects in Washington to manufacture silicon-based battery anodes. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The University of Wyoming is scrambling to address a major funding cut that state legislators passed in a footnote to its fiscal budget. During this year's session, Wyoming lawmakers banned appropriation dollars from funding the University of Wyoming Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, or DEI. The office has fostered inclusivity in race, sex, national origins, and gender identity since its founding in 2017, providing resources for language assistance, Americans with disabilities, religious accommodations, and more. The University of Wyoming is not alone in facing these cuts. Since 2021, more than 150 bills have been brought to state legislatures aimed at academic freedom and university governance, according to a new paper from the American Association of University Professors. Report author Isaac Kamola says that academic freedom is vital for higher education to serve the public interest.
The teaching and research that takes place within those institutions has to be free from external pressures to ensure that what takes place in the classroom and research pursues truth wherever it leads, not where those with political and economic power wishes that it leads.
Opponents of DEI initiatives say they lead to fear and resentment, but Kamola says the office closures are among several trending threats to higher education, including banning critical race theory, weakening tenure or accreditation, and mandating content. A working group provided suggestions to the University of Wyoming on how to proceed, including continuing DEI funding through private support under a changed name or reorganizing under a different university office. Kamola says when Texas universities took a similar approach, they were told they were in violation and a round of layoffs followed.
We can imagine that something similar might happen where the political operatives that are behind these attacks on DEI will want to see blood in the water.
The working group's report notes that the DEI office grounds its work in the Wyoming Constitution. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. I'm Kathleen Shannon reporting for Wyoming News Service.
A lawsuit is challenging the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' decision not to require a permit for the construction of a new refinery on the Columbia River. Next, Renewable Fuels has proposed a refinery for renewable diesel in a rail yard in Port Westward, near Clatskanie, Oregon. Columbia Riverkeeper staff attorney Audrey Leonard says the construction could threaten levee infrastructure and low-lying farmland nearby.
The reason that a permit would be required is to just ensure that all that activity doesn't degrade or harm the infrastructure.
The road could impact levee infrastructure built in 1915 to protect more than 5,700 acres of farmland. Leonard notes that NEXT has said it will need to conduct studies to determine how much weight the road and levee can withstand. The Army Corps claims the project will have no impact on the levee. Leonard says there is concern for a nearby Columbia River estuary as well.
It's a really important part of the Columbia River, really important for salmon and other fish, and essentially increasing more fuel traffic by barge, feedstock traffic, increases the risk of spill.
In their legal complaint, Columbia Riverkeeper and 1,000 Friends of Oregon say the project will destroy 120 acres of wetlands and store more than 1 million barrels of diesel and aviation fuel near the Columbia River. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, it'll be mostly clear tonight and tomorrow, with a low of 44 tonight, high 77 tomorrow, partly cloudy, low 51 Thursday night, mostly sunny Friday, high 68, breezy, west winds 15 to 20, gusts up to 30. Mostly cloudy Friday night, low 45, west winds 5 to 15, gusts up to 20, and a 20% chance of showers Saturday in the afternoon. Otherwise, mostly sunny, high 62. Mostly clear Saturday night and Sunday, low 38, and breezy Saturday and Saturday night, high 61 on Sunday. Currently, we have 68 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ, there's a PayPal option, and there's a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Flashpoints is up next, followed by Lockdown Mosh Pit, 7:30 to 8:30. And at 8:30, music begins in earnest with Grateful Dead Through the Decades. And at 10 o'clock, we'll have our weekly musical, What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
Foreign detainees at Guantanamo Bay who are still there.
America the beautiful, aspirational, welcoming place.
Do not have the right to make due process claims in court.
Or America the fearful, bitter, resentful, petty, not enough for all you foreigners place.
Peace Radio is back.
This is equally bummer.
Dear Mr. President.
Every other Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. here on KRFP 90.3 FM and online.
Pardoned by Trump.
You'll find that Native Americans are familiar with the idea that a pandemic is a great time for capitalists to make a profit.
Every other Sunday.
Much of Bezos' new wealth is a result of changing consumer habits during the pandemic.
This a message to my people, man. I know we only fighting to feel equal. Damn, use your words.
You have to stop. My eyes can't roll back any further.
People with no deceitful plan. Nah, stand together, we'll be better in the end. I'm only reaching out. I got a hand that I can lend. I hope.
Next episode, Sunday, June 16th, 2 to 4 p.m.